You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Tuesday, June 28, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Jamie Raskin, a law professor from the Washington College of Law. He's also a Democratic state senator from Maryland's 20th district, here to discuss yesterday's Supreme Court ruling coming out of Arizona on campaign finance laws. Also, today, more info on what got the Republicans to walk away from the debt deal, aside from general douchebaggery, and an update on the clown car race and the Republican primaries. But first, let us thank a couple of our Majority Report members. Robert Hindle from New York, thank you so much for becoming a member, a longtime member. Colette Linderman, thank you too for becoming a member. Mark Stein, thank you too, sir, for becoming a member. Remember, it is the members that make this show possible. The members that will keep this show going. If you have not become a member, I have one question for you. Why? Why would you not become a member? For only 50 cents a day, you can get the entire show as a podcast. And frankly, you can get any part of the show. You can keep the show alive by becoming a member. So please, I encourage you. I don't want to beg, folks. That would be untoward of me. But we are lagging behind on our projections. It becomes more pronounced with every day that goes by. Become a member. Give us 24 hours, in some instances 72 hours, to get your membership materials out. But once we send you your membership materials, you can go back and get access to all the past shows very easily. Become a member today. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it is time for our Apocalypse Report. That's right. Today, the apocalypse moved even closer. I'm not actually talking about the religious apocalypse. It just, we seem to have more and more... Well, I guess there's good news coming out of the Fukushima plant that they are able now to pump in treated water, treating the water that's there to cool itself. So that's supposedly a step in the right direction. Like, you know, it's seems to be quite hard to get actual information out of these situations to know just how bad it is, but... that's somewhat encouraging. Meanwhile, in Nebraska, we are perhaps maybe in danger of having our own meltdown of sorts, although it seems like the situation is under control. In Omaha, the Fort Calhoun nuclear station is in somewhat danger because there's a temporary levee has failed. It is, whatever you're doing is making me now have static. That's bad. Thank you. The facility had to briefly turn to emergency generated power. There's the Missouri River is flooding, and apparently They had placed a massive aqua dam where they fill up basically a balloon full of water to surround it. It's 8 feet tall and 16 feet wide. It's a huge balloon. And apparently somebody accidentally punctured it on Sunday with a machine. Whoops. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission inspectors were actually on site when it occurred. Waters rushed the auxiliary and other buildings at the site. The power supply was cut because water got into the main electrical transformers. Power has since been switched away from emergency generators to an off-site power supply. So they have power lines that apparently run above the plant. They can get power in that way. They also have a secondary set of backup generators that are higher up. But essentially, the Calhoun plant was built, can sustain floodwaters up to 1,014 feet. When the dam broke, the river was roughly at 1,007 feet or so. If they reach 1,009, the plant would likely switch from the lowest level of emergency status to the second of four emergency levels. And apparently, it was reported back on October of 2010, last year, that inspectors were in and came up with problems for stockpiled fuel for some of these power generators in these two plants, and they got them fixed in time without obviously knowing that there was going to be a flood. So thank you again for government regulation for at least preventing this disaster up to this point. And wildfires continue to creep right up to the Los Alamos National Laboratory. This is where we develop all our nuclear bombs and other sundry fun methods of creating mayhem and destruction around the world. New Mexico is keeping the facility closed for a second day today, as firefighters battle brisk winds and warm temperatures. No other fires are currently burning on lab property. No facilities face immediate threat, and all nuclear and hazardous materials are accounted for and protected.
Don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining.
The fire has spread across nearly 44,000 acres, undoubtedly set by, you know, Mexicans, according to John McCain. He said it. No, he didn't say it. He said it. He didn't say it. No, he didn't say it. All right, we've got to take a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Jamie Reskin, a law professor at the Washington College of Law, on this new Supreme Court ruling, the implications of the ruling on campaign finance, and a nascent rivalry between John Roberts and recently, not so recent, appointed Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Jamie Raskin. He is a law professor at the Washington College of Law and a Democratic state senator representing Maryland's 20th district. Welcome to the program.
Hey, my pleasure to be with you.
So this ruling in that has the Supreme Court has struck down a part of Arizona's public campaign finance law. Give us a sense of what this ruling said. What was at issue here?
Well, it was the key feature of Arizona's public financing regime, which said that if I run for, you know, pick the office, I might run for governor or state senate, whatever it might be, and I agree to accept public money, I get an initial increment of money. But then if I've got a privately financed candidate against me, that person, they outspend me to the one with the one of their against me. At that point, the public financing would kick in, so I would get an extra increment of money so that it would help me to have more speech so that I'm able to answer charges and so on. Well, the Roberts Court, in its wisdom on a 5-4 vote, struck it down, saying essentially that that violates the First Amendment rights of the privately financed candidate.
Now, this is a law that was approved by Arizona voters in 1998. It was a result of numerous political scandals in Arizona, and so what give me the sense of just how broad of a ruling this is, and let's talk a little bit about the give me a sense of how broad this ruling is. In other words, is it very specific to this, or is it attacking sort of the campaign finance regime, the whole notion of publicly funded candidates?
Yeah, I mean, it paints with a very broad brush. It's broad and it's terrible because the problem with public financing regimes is that you don't want to spend too much money. I mean, if I'm going to run, but I'm the only person in the race, you don't want to give me $1 million to run for the state Senate, right? On the other hand, you don't want to give me too little, because if you offer me $10,000, but then the privately financed candidates are able to go raise 80 or 100 or 200, it's not enough. Regimes like this basically solve the problem. They say, all right, you can run for state Senate, we'll give you $25,000, but if you get chance and you can document how much more over the privately financed candidates are going, we'll even up the score so that you're able to compete effectively in the speech market, essentially there. Well, that completely destroys that mechanism. Essentially, the Supreme Court has just determined that wealthier candidates, either candidates that are bankrolled with big bucks or that have their own money, not only have a right to spend to the heavens in order to win, but they have a right to freeze their political speech inequality over everybody else so that the public cannot even decide to subsidize other people's speech in order to have a competitive election.
Now, am I right in reading that the issue here was, as you're saying, is the trigger effect, and that the it was a 5-4 decision that John Roberts, writing for the majority, has a theory that in some way, if I as a state give money based on a trigger to a candidate who is receiving public money, that I am chilling the speech of the candidate who is getting private money, because I am discouraging them from spending more money, because the more money they spend, the more apt they are to trigger this publicly financed money. Is that the theory?
That is the theory. The funny thing about it is that it completely contradicts what they say about why wealthy people should be able to spend whatever they want, which is that more money just means more speech, and more speech is always healthier. So that just because you have more speech doesn't discriminate against anybody. So here, all the government is doing is allowing for more speech. How does that in any way penalize the speech of the privately financed candidate? They're still spending whatever they want. They're still speaking however much they want. But the court is saying that the wealthy candidate not only has a right to spend whatever he or she wants to get elected, but they've got a right to freeze the economic inequality that they've got vis-a-vis the rest of the field.
So let me ask you this. If this is their theory, the majority, how do they justify things like providing a license for broadcast networks? In other words, if the theory is that speech is not a function, that my freedom of speech is not simply a function of my ability to speak, but relative to the speech of someone else, how can the court abide by the notion that we provide licenses to some people to have a broadcast TV network, whereas I, as a private individual, I only have the ability to do a podcast?
Well, I mean, you know, there you're striking at, like, the very heart of, you know, free market ideology. You know, they think that it, they think that it violates the First Amendment rights of licensed broadcasters to impose on them any public interest or fair use obligations.
Jamie, I'm sorry. Jamie, I'm sorry. Our connection is bad. I'm going to have to let you go. We'll try and do this another time. Sorry about that. Okay. All right, folks. Sorry about that. I guess we got to remind people not to use the cell phone. Just couldn't hear him. But so this is. Let me go through this for you. But as we have said, this is a 5-4 decision coming out of Arizona. The Roberts Court has argued that the idea that this trigger would take place based upon the spending of one candidate inhibits their speech because it discourages them from spending more. And if you could hear him, the professor makes a very good argument here that the court has relied on the notion, on the premise, on the principle, that the more someone spends, it expands their speech. So there's nothing wrong with more money being spent by a private individual. They are making the argument that despite the fact, if you use that principle in giving another candidate more money, it would increase the aggregate of speech. They are then shifting into saying, well, no, because you are discouraging someone from spending money, i.e. speaking more, because you're giving money to their opponent, and they know that if I spend over a certain amount, it will trigger that money, and they may be less inclined to spend that more money. This is, of course, you really have to turn yourself into a pretzel to make this argument. And the point I was making in terms of the broadcast spectrum is that we know that the government takes our common resource, that being the over-the-air spectrum. We know that they license to broadcasters. If speech is a function of the relative amount of speech, in other words, if in some way the government discourages one party from speaking more because it may increase the speech of their opponent, how is it that the government allows for a television broadcast spectrum to be licensed? Because aren't you necessarily raising the bar to entry to the rest of us who might want to do a TV show if all I can do is do it online and the government is putting out, is licensing to another entity that actually will diminish my reach? I mean, if everybody could only have TV shows online, wouldn't I be more encouraged to actually put my TV show online? Because I would not have that bar to entry, which makes it so much easier for people just to flick on their television. The thing that the court is ignoring here is the idea that my having more speech inhibits someone else's speech. And Justice Kagan apparently was extremely, excuse the pun, vociferous and adamant in her dissent. And hopefully what we're seeing on the court is Justice Kagan quickly growing into, at least on this issue, a reminder that it seems that every Supreme Court justice that has been appointed probably in the past 50 years has moved the court to the right in terms of who they've replaced. But Kagan, at least, is being very forceful in this regard. Does it matter when it's 5-4? These five, Kennedy, Scalia, Scalito, Thomas, and Roberts, seem immovable on this point. But with that said, it is nice to have someone on the court who is going to argue this stridently, because one never knows. We are, you know, maybe Justice Thomas decides that he's embarrassed himself by breaking so many ethical codes that he'll resign. Highly unlikely, but who knows? I'm not going to wish ill upon any Supreme Court justice, but things, who knows what happens? I mean, it's very likely we're going to lose at least one member of the four block over the next 4 or 5 years. But one never knows. And so Rick Hazen at the New Republic has found a couple of pieces of good news in this ruling. Aside from, I guess I should say, there's some silver lining to this horribly dark cloud of the Supreme Court allowing for money to so corrupt our political process. One, he says, the Roberts Court seems to have retreated from the suggestion that was hinted at in Citizen United that all campaign finance laws, aside from disclosure, are in constitutional jeopardy. The issue is, of course, that without a trigger, how do you not waste money? How do you determine how much money a candidate is going to get? They are striking at the heart of the idea that we should, or that it's constitutional, to impose any measures that would somehow level the playing field between massive amounts of corporate or private money in our elections. That is the part that the five block abhors. The court was innocent. It was careful to say that it was not messing with the other type of campaign finance laws, that is, contribution limits. The Supreme Court, in this ruling, at the very least, has upheld the idea of contribution limits, which Citizens United sort of cracked open the door, and there were some cases around the country that had either been decided, I think there was one in Virginia, or were starting to be, people were arguing, the plaintiffs, the defendants were arguing that Citizens United allowed for it. The Supreme Court has basically shut the door to those arguments. Contribution limits, at the very least, seem to be safe for the time being. Secondly, this guy Hazen at Election Blog says that Justin Kagan is emerging as a forceful intellectual voice in favor of some type of campaign finance regulation, which is encouraging. And the last piece of news is that they didn't deal a death blow to the idea of publicly financed campaigns. The question is more about the pegging of this money, of triggering of these public funds to how much other candidates spend. So it's not clear whether or not you could actually have an all publicly financed campaign. That I think is not clear. However, there are, I guess, other programs around the country that may be in jeopardy. Specifically, New York City, Maine, New Mexico, North Carolina, and Wisconsin. They have trigger funds. Some cities, New York, San Francisco, these laws are now open to challenge. It remains to be seen in the future. So we will hopefully at another time bring on someone from the Supreme Court who is knowledgeable about such things, who not only is knowledgeable about the Supreme Court, but also has a landline or Skype. That nexus, or is not on vacation, that nexus apparently very difficult to find. In other related Supreme Court news, the court is about to hear a challenge to the FCC decency rules. As you know, the FCC does not allow you to say, what is it, those seven dirty words? I don't know. Fuck, shit, piss, vagina, penis. I don't know what the words are. But the whole regime of the FCC decency standards are being questioned. Yesterday, the court said it's going to take up the case to determine whether the FCC's enforcement of broadcast decency rules is constitutional. This is going to be interesting because FCC applies these rules only to broadcast networks that use the public spectrum. I mean, I don't know how they cannot have the rights to these rules, to impose these rules, and then we can't have porn everywhere. Honestly, I don't know how the court is going to argue that the government doesn't have the right to provide some regulation to a society-owned common resource. It seems to me it's not unlike the protection of our waters, of our air. But we shall see, folks. I mean, I'm not a big favor of any type of censor about words. I think people know that. But
interesting that video games were the tipping point.
Well, video games are different because video games have nothing to do with the commons. The real question is, how do you regulate video games, and or how do you not regulate video games, and then say you can't sell porn? We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a minute. The show is not over. We just had the wrong music in on the show. So the show is continuing on. We have another 10 minutes. Still doing a 40-minute show for the freebies. And meanwhile, the debt deal continues. I guess we're now 5 weeks away. It seems like every other day there is a different determination as to when we're going to have the financial meltdown that the Republicans seem hell-bent in forcing. Politico reports that on the reasons why Eric Cantor, was it Cantor, went away from the debt deal, ran away from the debt deal crying. There's a quote. And, of course, I think it was John Kyle. The apparently the teams headed up, and Obama, President Obama, now has joined into the fray, sitting down with Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell. Vice President Biden had agreed on cuts that totaled about $1 trillion over 10 years. They were shooting for $2.4 trillion in deficit reduction, which can be a function of cuts and tax increases. I tell you this story with the understanding that I hope you understand that I think dealing with deficit reduction at this time is folly, but is the folly that we are given. You deal with the folly that you have, not the folly that you wish you had. And so the Democrats wanted to essentially increase revenue by dealing with tax expenditures. You're going to hear more and more about this notion of tax expenditures in the coming days and weeks and months. Tax expenditures are essentially reductions in taxes that are loopholes or deductions. We collect a certain amount of taxes, and then you go back and say, we want to encourage certain behavior. And so we will give you a tax break for pursuing that behavior. There are two ways that government impacts society, either by spending on programs, which they want to encourage certain behavior or promote certain outcomes. We think GIs coming back from war should go to college, should have the opportunity to go to college. So 50% of the GIs that came back from World War II were essentially given funds to go to college. Not essentially, they were given funds to go to college. The government provided them access to colleges. Another way of doing that would be to say, anybody returning from war, we're going to give you a tax credit or a tax break or a deduction if you go to college. The differences of those two approaches in terms of the government's ledger or bookkeeping is nil. There is no difference. If you give $100 to a GI to go to college, or you give them a tax credit for $100, the difference is virtually nil. Is there administrative costs? Perhaps some very marginal differences. But the outcomes are probably better in terms of giving the GI $100, because they may not have, even though they get a tax break, they may not have the money to go to college. So they can get a tax break, but it doesn't really necessarily help them, because you're giving them $100 above and beyond what they already have. So the outcomes are generally a little more efficient when the government provides that funding. The other aspect of this is that that GI understands how they're going to college. While it may be the same in terms of the deficit and the burden on society, that tax expenditure or that direct funding, the recipient has a better notion of how they have this this ability. So with that said, what the Obama administration wants to deal with are tax expenditures, and specifically what they put on the table, which essentially caused Eric Cantor, here's a quote from him, to walk away, had to deal with the limiting of itemized deductions that wealthy Americans can claim on their tax return to a certain percent of their income. They were targeting the repeal of the carried interest tax break for investment fund managers. This allows managers of hedge funds, private equity funds, and venture capital funds to pay a 15% capital gains rate tax on their income instead of the commensurate income tax, whatever it would be for their whatever their income is. If it's above a certain point, it'd be 28%, et cetera, et cetera. And it also wanted to cut a tax expenditure called LIFO, last in, first out, manufacturers, which allows manufacturers to estimate the cost of goods they've sold at their most recent market prices. In other words, if I'm selling computers and I buy five computers for $60 and a month later I sell them each for $100, my revenue would be $40, and one would think that's what I am taxed upon in terms of the profits, you know, minus whatever cost of the business. Instead, what companies are allowed to do is I sell it at $100. The market rate for these is $100, so I will be able to pretend like I bought them at $100 and show no revenue, which makes their taxable income smaller. Those are the proposals that drove Eric Cantor and John Kyle crazy and made them run away crying about the Democrats' desire to actually raise revenue for this debt deal. It remains to be seen what will happen. I have every confidence in the world that Obama will negotiate a very tough deal that will be that will reduce spending cuts and raise revenue. Not really. Meanwhile, Eric Cantor, I guess he's not terribly worried about the idea of default. Wall Street Journal reports that Cantor actually invests in an exchange-traded fund that takes a short position in long-dated government bonds. He is essentially betting against U.S. Treasury bonds. So the market failure that would take place if the U.S. defaulted on its loans, which would be caused by a refusal to raise the debt ceiling, would actually benefit Cantor financially. I don't know how much, but it's always nice to hedge your bets, folks. You know, you Pete Rose. You're not sure how the team's going to do. If you win, you get a bonus. If you lose, you get a side bet in Vegas. What are you going to do? You know. Yeah, I'm having fun. Having fun betting on the game, that's all. I'm sure he bought those electronically, EFTs they're called. ETFs, electronic traded funds. I'm sure he bought that like at 3 in the morning on E-Trade or something. He was drunk. He's just like, sweet A. I just buy like $20,000, $15,000 worth of this. If we crash the government, we're going to win, baby. So meanwhile, turning to the Republican clown car, that is the Republican primary, I guess Republicans are in Iowa. Rick Santorum trying desperately. I got to think that Rick Santorum is looking out at the field and saying, well, wait, if Bachman wins, they're not going to need another Christian fundamentalist on the ticket. Let me see if I can create some foreign policy bona fides. So he's in Iowa, and he spews out this. Literally, you could say this if you had just read a Time magazine article. He doesn't read Time, I'm sure. I'm sure it's something like the right-wing equivalent of Time, because it's full of lies and ridiculousness. But my favorite part of this, of course, is when he uses the Rush Limbaugh construct of President Obama throwing people under the bus. That's a long-time construct when he threw Reverend Wright under the bus, and he threw this person under the bus. He mixes that metaphor with a pro-dictator sentiment. Beautifully done. Kudos to you, Mr. Man on Dog, and here is that sound now.
You're saying, well, you know, let's go after America's allies, because America's going to back down and not support them. Well, obviously the first ally in the region is Israel. And so why are we seeing boldly the Egyptians post-Mubarak bringing Hamas and the Palestinian Authority together in an alliance? Okay? So Obama throws Mubarak under the bus. The new regime, military regime in Egypt, brokers a deal between Hamas and the PA, and now the president rewards that by saying, we're going to go back to the 67 border. You don't have to be a rocket scientist if you're sitting there in the Arab-Muslim world thinking, well, how do we deal with this guy?
Well, and I think Santorum's hoping that there's no rocket scientists in his audience or anyone who has any notion of what he's talking about, because A, Obama never said we're going back to the 67 borders. B, it has been longstanding policy of the United States government to essentially go back to the 1967 borders. C, the idea that President Obama had the ability to throw Mubarak under the bus or do anything in that situation is a complete folly and lie. And D, one would expect that we would actually want the freedom of the Egyptian people to overthrow their dictator. And I would also say that and I love how he says the PA and Hamas, because I can guarantee you there is no one in his audience in Iowa who knows what he's referring to as when he says the PA. They don't know there's the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. They just don't. I know they don't. They just know there's Hamas and the Palestinians. And they probably don't even know about that deal between Hamas and the Palestinians. And they probably don't realize that the reason why Hamas has more legitimacy in Palestine and the Palestinian territories is because the Bush administration forced these elections on the Palestinians at a time where everyone who had any sense of anything understood that Hamas was going to win. They're the legitimately elected representatives of the Palestinians. And the idea of splitting Hamas and the Palestinian Authority and trying to isolate Hamas has categorically and unequivocally failed to bring any progress to peace. But, I mean, isn't somebody in that audience going like, wait, hey, weren't we in favor? I mean, wasn't Mubarak a dictator? I mean, what? How is this helping? So he's sitting out there talking to the Christian Zionists and trying to position himself as a guy who, I know foreign policy, PA, man. I just referred to Hamas as H. Meanwhile, Chris Wallace, who apologized to Michelle Bachmann yesterday for asking her about her profile as a flake, should have probably waited a day or two. Michelle Bachmann's claim that she never gotten a penny from a family farm that's been heavily subsidized by the government is apparently at odds with her financial disclosure statements. Maybe she thought that nobody would read those. Her financial, she claims that the farm is her father-in-law's. It's not my husband. It's not my farm. It's my father-in-law's farm. And my husband and I have never gotten a penny of money from the farm, she said on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace. Turns out Political Act has found that in personal financial disclosure reports required annually from Congress, Bachmann reported that she had an interest in the family farm with her share worth between $100,000 and $250,000. She received as much as $105,000. Somewhere between $32,000 and as much as $105,000 from 2006 to 2009. That's chump change from that farm. A farm which, over the course of 15 years, received over nearly $260,000 in federal payments. that would be even more than the amount that she got from it. So one could say all of that money came from taxpayer dollars. She also apparently thought that John Wayne was born in Waterloo, Iowa. It turns out it was John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne only pretended to kill a lot of people in his movies. John Wayne Gacy apparently killed 33 men and boys. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? She went on to say on Face the Nation on Sunday that it's ironic and sad that the president released all of the oil from the Strategic Oil Reserve. The really ironic and sad part was that he only released about 4% of the Strategic Oil Reserves. Bachman said in Iowa, the number of new drilling permits under the Obama administration since they came into office is one. And one should be so lucky from my perspective, because the Obama administration has issued more than 200 new drilling permits before the Gulf oil spill, and 60 since that time. So she's an idiot, but I still contend that she's a dangerous idiot, because she is just a religious fundamentalist. And now we come to the end of the program. I want to remind you, you can support this show by buying your crap through our Amazon link at majority.fm. You can support this show and get great fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate from justcoffee.coop. Put the coupon code majority in the coupon box. Get a 10% discount. Come up and on the post show, New Jersey. About to get one of those payday loans from JP Morgan Chase. Presumably to help finance the America Mall. What is it there? What is it? Freedom Mall.
The American Dream.
The American Dream.
If you're a wrestling fan, just think of Dusty Rhodes.
Well, that's very appropriate, though, the American Dream. I don't know Dusty Rhodes.
He was a wrestler from the 80s.
And was he the American Dream?
The American Dream, Dusty Rhodes.
You'll be able to get there on Chief J. Strongbow Drive. Also, good news for those people who want to have less jobs in this country. The elite in Washington may have come to a deal on more free trade. And Anonymous, they're back at it. We will talk about that in the post show. Plus, I will take your IMs at Majority FM is our IM. You can call at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.